19 lip bloggers, one finalist, 5 nominees, one, finalist, 5 authors, 1 podcaster, 5 Mondays, 5 interviews, 1 podcast. Anyway, the hell with it. It's the LBC Podcast! Reading time is a factor in this, so please pay attention. Answer as quickly as you can. You're in a library, walking among the books, when all of a sudden you look down and see a...
What one?
What?
What library?
It doesn't make any difference what library. It's completely hypothetical.
But how come I'd be there?
Maybe you're read up. Maybe you want a new literary diversion, an overlooked title. Who knows? So you look down, and you see a dystopian work of fiction. It's depressing as hell, and...
Dystopian fiction? What's that? Ever read 1984? Of course.
Same thing.
I never picked up a dystopian work of fiction, but I understand what you mean.
You reach down and you see that the book is Divided Kingdom by Rupert Thompson. But you're not reading.
What you mean I'm not reading?
I mean you're not reading. Why is that, Leon? They're just questions, Leon. It's a test designed to provoke a post-structuralist response. Shall we continue? Describe, in declarative sentences, only the good books you'd recommend to Dr. Joyce Brothers.
Dr. Joyce Brothers?
Yeah.
Let me tell you about Dr. Joyce Brothers.
So, I have here Megan of Bookdwarf, who is
hello.
Hello, how you doing? Who nominated Rupert Thompson's Divided Kingdom. Now, Megan, I was wondering if you could tell us exactly what it was about Divided Kingdom that sort of struck your fancy that made it, this is the LBC nominee.
I guess it was the premise of the novel that sort of got my attention in the beginning. It seemed so hokey at first, and I didn't think that I'd actually enjoy the book. And then about 50 pages in, it grabbed me, and I couldn't stop reading it until I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably one of the best books I've read in the past year, so...
What was it about it that grabbed you?
Well, I mean, the premise is, you know, dividing the England into the 4 humors, and you know, putting the various people, assigning them to a category, which sounds kind of dumb at first, but the way he writes it, I think he's very character-driven,
mm-hmm.
Rupert Thompson, and he builds the scene very well, and then describes things very well, and I just love the whole story, so...
Now, had you read any Rupert Thompson before this, or...?
No, in fact, I think it was Maude Newton who had first mentioned this book on her website,
mm-hmm.
and she sort of started raving about Thompson and how excited she was with the new book, and I just so happened to get a hold of a galley that same day from the Random House rep.
Oh, cool.
A friend of mine, so...
Gotcha. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Megan.
No problem.
Okay.
Hi-ho, it's home from Earth we go.
So, I am here with Rupert Thompson, LBC nominee for his novel, Divided Kingdom. How are you doing, Rupert?
I'm very well, thank you, Ed.
So, I wanted to first of all kind of get a sense of where did this idea come from? It struck me as a very, having a country divided by 4 humors struck me as a very unusual concept, and yet you somehow managed to make it work quite well and managed to convince me. I was wondering what steps you made to actually get this to happen as a writer.
Many, many steps is the answer. I mean, when I what tends to happen with me is that my ideas, when they first occur to me, aren't really ideas. They're not even so much as germs. They're some fragment that I find myself for some reason interested in. And in this case, all I really had at the beginning was the idea, or rather the memory of this one girl, actually. It was a girlfriend of a friend of mine back in the early 80s in London, and she was Swedish, but she was unusual because every time you saw her, she was always smiling, always in a good mood. I mean, so much so that it began to irritate, you know, the rest of us, and we thought, how can anyone be so unremittingly cheerful? And simply that idea of I started thinking, well, how common is that? I mean, how many people like that are there, you know, who are just naturally cheerful all the time? And that was the beginning. It sounds really inauspicious, I know, and no one else could probably have turned it into a novel. But that's where it started. And then the next step would have been really a year later, bumping into a professor of medieval history at a party in London again. And he started talking about the humours. for some reason, and I suddenly put that together with, I put the idea of a sanguine personality together with the memory of that Swedish girl, and I suddenly thought, well, okay, there's not just one type, what if there were four types, and what if a country was divided up in that way? And even then, it was, and this tends to happen with most of my ideas, it seemed totally implausible, and yet it seemed to throw down a gauntlet, you know, it seemed to be saying, see what you can make of this.
Well, the impressive thing about this novel is I looked at the back of the book and saw all of these very copious books that you had used for research. To synthesize all that into what I felt was very sparkling prose. I mean, I'm wondering what level of craftsmanship or how many drafts did it take to sort of get it down to a point where the story just moved and sparkled on the page?
No, that's a good question because there was a lot of research, oddly, for this book, despite it really being a work of the imagination almost entirely. It was just that at certain points, I found myself, you know, I would be writing about one particular kind of society, say a benevolent dictatorship, which I thought the sanguine part of the novel is like, and I would suddenly think about Singapore and Lee Kuan Yew, and I'd think, wait a minute, how did that work? And I'd read a book about Lee Kuan Yew running Singapore in the 60s, 70s, and I'd realize there were things in common there, and also tiny things I could draw on. At the same time, the danger is, I think, if you're writing a book like this, is you know, the research can overwhelm you, and I think I've always had this theory that you have to balance the imagined facts against real facts, and for me, imagined facts are much, much more important. So generally, I try and write a first draft without doing any research at all. And the first or second draft will then throw up kind of research I need to do, and that gets absorbed into third, fourth draft. And my books tend to go through as many as 10, 11, 12 complete drafts, probably. And when I say, you know, that not only means going from the beginning to the end, it also means that I'm going back within that draft. So, and just to give you an idea of what that might mean with Divided Kingdom, because at one point Divided Kingdom was close to 900 pages long.
Wow.
Something like, it was well over a quarter of a million words, and it was getting out of control. And that draft took 5 months of working 7 days a week. You know, it almost killed me. But I mean, it had to be done, because it was one of those books that had to be written long before it could be written short. You know, I had to imagine everything and then remove what I'd imagined. Otherwise I'd be cheating the reader, I felt. You know, I had to really know how each of these four countries worked, how it would have been at the beginning, how it would have been 25 years later. And so all that had to be imagined. But then once I'd imagined it, you realized, God, this is not so much a novel as a textbook, you know. So I had to just then start taking it back down and trying to work out what exactly it should be about, right?
Well, it's interesting that is your process, because the actual text itself reminded me very much of the way that you read an Ian McEwan novel and the sentences just literally snap out at you because they are so precise, because McEwan is just absolutely ruthless about the way that he sort of, you know, compresses his text.
Well, I mean, this is the bit where craft takes over from inspiration. You know, I mean, to me, that people always. People talk a lot about inspiration, and you know, for instance, when I came to Barcelona, they said, "Oh, have you gone there for inspiration?" And I don't need to go anywhere for inspiration, for a start. And the second point is that inspiration is really kind of the start of it, and I suppose it's the fire of it and everything. It's where a book begins, but most of writing is really about craft and about the kind of applying of really ruthless technique to what you've imagined, you know. And I mean, I'm getting better at that. I mean, I think if you ever look at my first book, you'll see Dreams of Leaving, it was called, and it had a kind of wonderful sort of spirit on the page, because it was completely free, and it was like you could tell that it was someone writing for the first time, and everything was in there, you know. But it had a lovely anarchy about it, but it didn't have such a great discipline, you know. And I can forgive myself for that, I suppose, but I think as you go on, you start to be, I think you just get harder and harder on yourself, and there is that sort of delicious moment where you actually remove a whole page or that's actually beautifully written but doesn't need to be there. And I think when you find yourself doing things like that, you know you're beginning to learn something about, you know, what writing is.
At the same time, the interesting thing about this book is that there are like little goofball moments of humor, such as the surfing thing, which I found really amusing myself.
They shouldn't sort of stick out as I didn't intend them to be vignettes exactly. You know, I wanted it all to be part of the same thing, and yeah, they're kind of they're pretty surreal, and there are surreal elements to all of the four parts of the Divided Kingdom. You know, they all have their moments, as it were.
Well,
and they sort of need their moments, yeah. And I love the idea of, as soon as I thought of subterranean surfing, I had to write that scene.
There was one motif in this book that I noticed quite a lot, and there was a lot of curlicue imagery. You have the salamander, you have the question mark here. I was wondering if what was the conscious move to put that in there?
No, that's the kind of thing you as a clever reader would pick up, and I probably would have just done subconsciously. I mean, obviously there are some things you do intentionally, but I mean, it reminds me of the story about Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, because I think his one of his children went off to school and they were actually reading one of his short stories that day in school, and the teacher said, you know, there's this cockerel in the story, and what do you think the writer intends this to mean? What's it supposed to symbolize? And people had all kinds of the children had all kinds of ideas about what this cockerel was supposed to symbolize, and the son or the daughter went home to her father, the writer, and said, this cockerel in your story, Dad, you know, what's it mean? And Gabriel Garcia Marquez said, it's just a cockerel. It's just a cockerel, you know. There are things that you put in because there are things that you put in without knowing that you're putting them in. And intuition, I think, is a huge part of what a novelist has to have in their armory, if you like. I mean, I think you have to completely rely on your intuition. You have to trust it. It has to be your friend. And if it isn't, then I think you're probably in trouble.
Do you feel that, well, particularly here in the States, I think it's more present than it is perhaps in Europe, but being pigeonholed as a speculative fiction author, and whether that gets in the way of people sort of, you know, enjoying Divided Kingdom and many of the ideas and the descriptions and the prose that's there. Does that, you know, is that something that you think about? Is that something that you think you were fighting to sort of escape, or?
It is something I think about. I mean, I'm not sure what I can do about it exactly, because in fact, I think it's partly because I've always eluded pigeonholes. I mean, I sort of think probably what I write is, there's this wonderful word, genre-defying, you know, and it's sort of, I use lots of genres in my writing, and often two or three or four in a single book, and yet it doesn't seem to be any one of those things. You know, you couldn't say Divided Kingdom is science fiction, you couldn't say it's a satire, you couldn't say it's a love story, and yet it's got elements of all those genres in it. And I think critics, when I've read them, especially in England, have always tried to kind of put what I do in one pigeonhole or another. You know, for a while I was a thriller writer, and for a while I was a cult writer, and you know, I've been lots of things actually, and maybe I'm now a writer of speculative fiction, but I mean, it won't necessarily last, because the next book, which is almost finished, is very precisely set, not only geographically but in time, and so there's nothing speculative about it in that sense at all. So, you know, I mean, I'm quite happy to go on sort of wrong footing the people who are trying to pigeonhole me.
Well, this book is really, really tightly plotted. It's very much a sort of quest tale, but at the same time, it's a little bit more than that, because we talked about the ideas. I'm wondering, to what extent do you design or write a novel to be entertaining, and to what extent would it be literary for you?
Well, I mean, ideally, of course, it should be both. I mean, I think the point about entertaining the reader is an important one, because I think you have to do that. I mean, I oddly enough, I'm lucky in that way. I mean, I seem to write books, even though I don't have massive sales. I mean, it seems that anyone who does read any of my books can't put it down. I mean, this is what I get told a lot. You know, they read the books pretty fast, and they get locked into them, and they can't. You know, they can't put it down until they've really got to the end of it, and then they carry on thinking about it. And that's fine by me. And in fact, a lot of the time, what I'm trying to do these days is working against that and trying to slow the reader down, you know, because I've now got this awareness of having some kind of natural page-turning quality to what I do. And sometimes I think if what you write have too much of that, then the readers are going to miss a lot of what's in it, because most readers, after all, don't read a novel twice, you know. I mean, I read my own novel hundreds and hundreds of times, so I build all kinds of things into it. And you want the reader who reads the book one time to get as much out of it as they can. So rather perversely, I'm sort of trying to work against my page-turning quality slightly and just slow things down. I'm not sure how successful I'm being at that. But in terms of being literary, I've always thought of myself in that bracket. I mean, it's simply because I'm trying to use language in an original way. I'm trying to push the fiction into areas it might not have been before. You know, you're trying to do something new, and it's really difficult. I mean, it's almost impossible. But part of that is to do with the voice that you have and the voice that you develop. And despite the fact I think of all my books being rather different, at least, you know, in terms of when you first look at them in a very superficial way, I think that there's a voice that runs through all of them somehow, and you can sort of recognize that the voice is mine. So yeah, the literary side of things is important, but it does, as you say, you know, it does get muddied slightly by people trying to put me in one genre or another.
Well, speaking of the voice, one thing that was actually kind of a pleasure to read, I felt that the protagonist's voice, your voice, kind of sort of came through. There was a lot of, as to the so-and-so, you know, when he was describing the things, I noticed that. A lot of sort of, you know, kind of repetitive phrases and things like that that really kind of helps to get the reader on course.
It was a very hard thing to write him because, obviously, I'm writing him in the first person.
Yeah.
And he, you know, obviously he's not me. The problem with writing Thomas Parry in Divided Kingdom was that, in a way, he's not a real person. I mean, he's a kind of construct because, you know, here's a man who, as an eight-year-old boy, was taken away from his parents and placed in a new family, given a new name, a new upbringing, and a completely different identity, and an artificial identity, you know. And so, you really, what the voice that you're listening to is that of an artificial being, a kind of non-entity, trying to find who he was, you know, trying to find almost something human in his background and trying to find out the human being that he was. So it was actually really, really difficult voice to do. And at certain points, you know, at certain drafts, I found him getting terribly cold and getting terribly abstract. And I had to make sure that despite him being artificial, he was somehow, he was somehow human. The warmth that would have been there originally kind of bled through. But it was difficult. I mean, it took a lot of work to get that voice right.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, the book, you know, selling the illusion hinges entirely upon that voice.
Mm.
And the thing.
He's your guide. Yeah. He's your guide.
Yeah.
To it. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it's such the thing. I was reading this, and I couldn't put it down either. But at first, I was sort of like, this is utterly preposterous. But as he's telling the story, I'm like believing it more and more and more.
Well, it is preposterous. Of course, it is preposterous, especially when if you describe it in two or three sentences to someone, they'll say that couldn't happen. You know, I just don't believe that, and you're going to have to convince me. And of course, what I try and do in the book is convince the reader and persuade them into the reality of that situation. But also, I mean, I often think that this book was really inspired, or really where it comes from is the time I spent in Berlin in the early 80s before the wall came down, you know, and I found myself living in this divided city. And it seemed to me at the time, well, it was, on the one hand, it was very exciting, but at the same time, it was utterly artificial. And I thought I would sometimes just pinch myself to make sure it was real, because I would look around and think, how can people actually live this way? I mean, how have they allowed this to happen?
Yeah.
This wall to be built down the middle of their city, you know, how they allowed themselves to be separated from their loved ones in this way, and yet it was a reality. It happened, you know. And so I think those kind of ideas interest me, because you may have something, you know, you have a world that you have a parallel world, if you like, an artificial reality, but it's shot through by very real human emotions. I mean, Divided Kingdom is full of emotion, I hope anyway. I mean, it's shot through with feelings of love and loss and grief and all those things. In fact, I think that's the way in which it becomes believable, because if the reader gets involved in that in the book at all, it's through those emotions and through identifying with those. So, you know, at the core, the book is very human indeed, but it spans a big. It's got a big span to it, you know, right from the artificial idea in the first place, right down to the very human emotion that the characters have as they're going through it.
My phone is inexplicably dying. I thought it was fully charged, but I will try to ask you a few questions before it dies. But first off, there have been a lot of comparisons between this book and Orwell, and saying that this is the best dystopian novel since 1984. Was Orwell much of a presence when you were actually writing this book? Not at all,
actually. And at the same time, as I was writing it, I had a kind of wry smile on my face, because I thought, oh, I know what they're going to say. You know, they're going to mention Orwell. They're probably going to mention Huxley, Brave New World, and they're probably going to mention, they might mention, I don't know, Margaret Atwood, The Handmaid's Tale. And I was supposed to be imagining.
You
can't help but imagine the critics. But funnily enough, because I didn't approach the novel in that way. You see, I didn't start off thinking I'm writing a dystopian novel or something. I started off with this, as I described right at the beginning of this, you know, a very sort of quirky, simple, kind of fairly inauspicious idea, you know, or even thought. And I didn't know where it was going to lead me.
What about...
The second thing is, if I could just say it,
it's just
that it's, of course, not futuristic at all, you know. I mean, Orwell wrote 1984 in 1948.
Yeah.
So he was setting the book 40 years or whatever ahead of when he was writing, and this book to me, I mean, Divided Kingdom to me is very much a kind of alternative present. It's not the future at all. And if you look at it carefully, you'll see there are mobile phones and there are computers very much as we have them now, except that certain societies have distilled what we have, or removed it, or advanced it. But it's very much an alternative present, and so I'm not really kind of making predictions or prophecies. I'm just simply trying to unveil. Yeah, I'm trying to sort of say, well, what if something had happened 25 years ago, and what if the present was completely different? How could it, you know, how would it be? What would things look like? How would people be living? So, you know, it's speculative, but it's not futuristic.
Well, it also reminded me very much of Anthony Burgess's The Wanting Seed, in the sense that it's also a similarly kind of absurd idea that is convincing, but at the same time there are elements of humor throughout, you know? Was that an influence for you, or...?
I don't know that book at all. I've read a bit of Anthony Burgess, but not for a long time. And I read Clockwork Orange, obviously, I suppose, and I read the Enderby novels, the novels about the poet. But the one you mentioned, though, I don't know that one.
You should check it out. It's basically this world in which there's an overpopulation problem, and then basically they do two things. One, they encourage homosexuality. Two, they encourage cannibalism. So it kind of reminded me. It's interesting. Well, speaking of influences, what are some of your literary influences?
Well, I mean, to bring the last two questions together, I mean, I think a book, you know, to me, Divided Kingdom bears much more relation to a book like The Master and Margarita, which is Mikhail Bulgakov. I don't know whether you know that novel.
Yes.
But that's like a Russian novel from the, I think it was written in the 30s. Written under Stalin, and that novel has all those elements in it. It's a satire. It's a piece of surrealism. It's almost got a thriller element, and it's absurd as well in the way that you're calling my idea absurd. I mean, you know,
in a good way, though.
The devil arrived in Moscow in the guise of a black cat. I mean, that's pretty bizarre, and yet that book, you know, he makes it work. There's an amazing humor running through that book as well. So that to me is just one of the great books, and you know, I tend it tends to be books rather than writers. I mean, so the other books for me that are influences, and I suppose when you say influences, what I really mean is books I wish I'd written, would be, I mentioned Marquez earlier, but The 100 Years of Solitude would be one. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Murakami.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? Toni Morrison, actually, The Song of Solomon is the book I go back to. Gunter Grass, The Tin Drum. And then quite a lot of American things. I mean, almost anything Flannery O'Connor wrote. You know, I mean, I sort of think of her as my literary godmother or something. And William Faulkner as well. I mean, and books like As I Lay Dying are books that often are on my writing table when I'm writing, and I kind of will open them and look at them. And you're not reading the book exactly for what it is, you're just kind of trying to remind yourself of what's possible or what's good.
Okay. Well, I don't want the phone to die, so Rupert, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ed.
And